call this meeting of the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:30 p.m. It's Wednesday, February 25th, 2023. Before we begin, I want to thank Joanna Crescette, the Senate Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Amanda Kraft from the Juneau LIA, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Senator Giesel, Senator Tobin, my Vice Chair, Senator Keough, and myself, Senator Clayman, will have a quorum to conduct business. I expect Senator Kaufman will arrive late, but not here yet. Our first and only order of business today is a Department of Law Criminal Division overview. Today we are joined by John Skidmore, Deputy Attorney General of the Criminal Division. Mr. Skidmore, if you would please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and you can begin your remarks. And unless you have objections, if they have questions in the midst, we'll just make you pause.
That works well. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is John Skidmore. It's nice to be back in front of Senate Judiciary. For those of you that already know me, it's nice to see you again. For those that I haven't had a chance to meet yet, I look forward to the opportunity to do that in the near future. The overview that I was asked to present today is really about the sex offense report that was produced related to offenses that occurred in that were referred in FY 2021, as well as recruitment and retention efforts that the department has been engaged in over the last several years. I wasn't really planning to do more of an overview of the criminal division beyond that. However, if you all have questions, I'm more than happy to answer any questions about the work of the criminal division today. Just briefly, for those of you that may not know me, I've been a prosecutor with the Department of Law now for the last 25 years. I've been in the role as the Deputy Attorney General for the last 3 years and within the central office, which really manages the supervision and overseeing of the division statewide for about the last 12 years. So without any further ado, let me turn to the sex offense report.
I'll note that Representative Kaufman now has joined us. He said he'd be late, but he isn't very late.
That sex offense report is prepared pursuant to Alaska Statute 4423040, and it was a new requirement that was added to the statutes about 3, maybe 4 years ago now. And so this version of the report is only the third time that we've actually had to produce the report itself. The requirement of the report is that we provide information about offenses that were referred and what's happened with those offenses that were referred to us. And it specifies sex offenses, which has a particular meaning within the law. If we move to slide 2, I want to talk a little bit about the scope. And I've described some of this a little bit to you, but I want to go into a little more detail. We're going to start with cases that were referred between between 2020 and June 30 of 2021. As you may note, that's not the last fiscal year, that's a year prior to that. And the reason that there's that year's lag time is that sex offenses, we have found, take generally at least 2 years to process through the system. And so we didn't want to be reporting on everything immediately. We were trying to give a little bit more time of those offenses. And so each report has followed this same methodology. In 2019, when we issued the report, did I do that right? This is 2023, so I did that wrong. In 21 and in 20, when we issued the reports, it was always a 2-year look back, dealing with the cases from FY19, FY20, and now FY21. And when we talk about cases that are sent to us, there are various ways in which you can try and group offenses or take a slice of the cases that you want to analyze. And those are really the bullet points that you see here on the slide. You could look at the date that the offense occurred. You could look at the date that the offense is referred to our office. You could look at the date that we actually file charges or make a screening decision. You could look at a conviction date, or you could look at a sentencing or judgment date. Each one of those is individual and distinct. For instance, we have offenses that will occur in 1 year, and it can take a period of time for the investigation to work its way through before it's ever actually referred to us. And so if you are only looking at the offense date, you're going to get cases that are referred to us kind of scattered all over the place, and it doesn't make sense to look at those all at the same time. The referral date are all of those referred to our office within a particular calendar year, and that's the easiest way to track cases. That's actually the way the department has historically looked at its statistics back for more than the last 20 years. The filing or the screening date is when we make a decision on the case. That is not necessarily the best way to do it, and we're going to get an example of that a little later on when we talk about the report itself. We had cases that were referred to us in this time frame that at the time of the report, we still had 30 of them, unfortunately, that we had not yet made a decision on. So the timing of when the decision is made runs the risk that you miss out on some of the cases that are there. Finally, the conviction date is when somebody has either entered the plea or the jury trial is completed, but it's not necessarily the sentencing date. And that's a distinction, as you see the next bullet point there, is the sentencing or judgment. And trying to look at a conviction date or a sentencing or judgment date means you would look at the cases that are resolved in a given year, but you don't really have a feel of how many are coming in. So I hope that helps explain how we chose the referral date as the grouping that we wanted to look at. And then sex offenses, as I indicated in my comments just a few moments ago, has a specific meaning. In Alaska Statute 1263-100 subsection 7, a sex offense is specifically defined in the law as those offenses that are registrable. And you think to yourself, well, aren't most offenses registrable? The answer is many are, but not all of them. And if you go to that next bullet point, you note that sex offense definition has actually been amended multiple times since it was first implemented in 1994. To give you more details on this, we're going to move to slide 3. This is actually table 3 of the report that I believe was distributed to each of you prior to the hearing as well. And this table 3 is actually found in Appendix A in the report itself. It goes through and lists all of the offenses that fall within the definition. So you can see that it includes all of the sexual assault crimes. For the sexual abuse of minor, it includes the first through the third, the fourth. Not all of the ones in the fourth are included. You have to drop down to the specific subsections of statutes, and you see that sexual abuse of a minor in the fourth degree, some of those are registrable, but not all of them. You then go on and you have several of the other sex offenses that are listed there, but it doesn't include absolutely everything. And I'll give you an example. We have a crime in the state of Alaska called misconduct involving a corpse. One of the subsections is if somebody engages in sexual penetration with a corpse. Most of us would think of that and go, well, that's clearly a sex offense. It's not defined that way under the statute. So I just want to bring that clarity to you all that sometimes you'll hear people in the building use the term sex offense, and that should be an indication to you that you should ask them, are you talking sort of generically in a common sense meaning, or are you referring to only those offenses that are registrable? Because there is a difference.
Just out of curiosity, you raised the topic of sex with a corpse.
Yes.
Have you prosecuted sex with a corpse any time recently?
Recently, no. In my career, yes.
How about like the last 5 years or longer ago than that?
Well, unfortunately, I've been in the central office for the last 12 years, so I really haven't handled many cases in that time frame.
Okay. But fair to say it's rarely prosecuted.
It is a rare offense that occurs. Yes. Unless there are any other questions, I'm going to move on to slide 4 then. And I wanted to just comment on a couple of the noteworthy aspects of the report before I get into some of the statistics that are found in the report. And the things that I would want to point out are that the vast majority of the cases are still active prosecutions. That is, as I've already explained to you, we tried to have that lag time. Even with that lag time, though, what we found in the last 3 years of providing the report, by the time we provide the report, though it's 2 years later, the vast majority, well over 50%, in fact, over 70% of the cases are always still pending prosecution. What does that highlight? Well, from my perspective, it highlights how long it takes a sex offense to work its way through the criminal justice system. That's a challenge. I wish I had good solutions for you of how to make that go faster. We've tried various things over the years. We have not yet been successful in finding something to make those cases process faster. But that is a challenge that we face in our criminal justice system, particularly for sex offenses. The second thing that I wanted to highlight, and this is actually specifically commented on within the report itself, and that is that for this particular report, we are looking at a cohort or a group of offenses that were referred to us during COVID. And during COVID, what that meant is that because of the health restrictions that needed to be in place, the court system was not operating very many, not none, but not very many trials. And if you can't do trials, unfortunately, that means a lot of our cases were not resolving. There were some cases that happened during COVID. I know of at least 5 sex offenses that were prosecuted during that time frame. But that's a very small number compared to what we're actually usually able to do in terms of trials. And again, the next thing that I wanted to highlight is the report is based on data from a sampling that was taken on October 12th of 2022. In other words, we've had several months that have gone by since that time. One of the statistics I'm going to talk to you about in a moment is cases that are still in screening. That was as of October 12th of 2022. And I would want to assure you that when we find issues such as cases have taken a long time for the screening decision to be made, we are responding to that. I wish I could tell you today how many of those cases are completed in screening. Unfortunately, we have challenges with our case management system and some technology that I don't want to go too far into because those are budget requests that we have for this year trying to help us resolve those issues. But needless to say, I couldn't get to the answer, though I do know I've had correspondence from many of our offices telling me, yes, cases have now been screened, so the number is far less than 30 still in screening. I cannot definitively tell you that all 30 have been screened. It is also a report based on information drawn from that moment in time on October 12th, which means it's telling you about convictions that had occurred as of that date, not as of today, pleas that had occurred as of that date, not as of today. So there's more processing of these cases since then. I just can't tell you definitively how much more has occurred. I'm then going to move to slide 5, which is really the statistics. And I apologize, that looks a little blurry to me on the screen. But in the report itself, that's where this graph is taken from. And I guess when I attempted to take a picture of it and then put it into the presentation, it didn't come out as crispy as I would have liked. It's on page 2 of the report itself, and what it tells you is the cases that referred to us between July 1 and June 30 of the years that we've previously talked about. There were 586 referrals made to us for a sex offense. Of those, we declined 279. That's approximately 48% of the cases referred to us, we declined. We do that primarily for evidentiary reasons. Sex offenses, by and large, are dealing with issues of consent or dealing with ages, dealing with elements of the crime, such as the age of the victim, the age of the offender, whether or not there's an appropriate difference in the age range for them, other elements of that nature. And though sometimes conduct occurs and somebody says, hey, this looks like it should qualify, when it comes to us, we have to look at it and say, we are not going to be able to prosecute that offense. We have an obligation to prove things beyond a reasonable doubt. And if we do not think that we can prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, then our obligation is really not to be accepting those cases. So I know that that seems like a high statistic, but our obligation is not simply to convict folks. It's to make sure that we're seeking justice. And if we don't think there's sufficient evidence there, that means we're obligated to say we're not going to be accepting that charge. You see the statistic there, still in screening of 30. I've commented on that a little bit already. I believe that number today is lower than 30, but there were a number that were still in screening. We've noted in doing this report for the last 3 years that each time we've done it, though it is a small percentage of the overall number, there are still cases in the double digits each time we've run the report that were still in screening. That's one of those things that we are working to try and clean up. One of our goals is to have all sex offense cases screened in a much shorter period of time than this. This would mean that something was in screening potentially for as long as 18 months, could be as short as 6 months. Either way, to me, that's an unacceptable period of time for it to be in screening. Sometimes there's additional investigation that has to be done. That's absolutely one of the things we found when we go back and look at these cases. But if we've asked for additional investigation and months have gone by and we don't have a response, we have an obligation to be taking some action on that. So those are the types of things that we need to be paying attention to. Except that as a non-sex offense, I apologize in trying to get that particular box on here. It seems to have omitted the number. The number is 16 that should be there, and that number is clearly found within your report itself. Of the cases that are referred to us, we accepted 261 for sex offense prosecutions. And then below that in this flowchart, you really have the disposition of those. You start on the left for the cases we dismiss, and you may be asking yourselves, if you've accepted it, why do you turn around and dismiss it? The answer to that is that once we've accepted a case, that's not the end of the investigation. And investigation goes on. And if we find additional information, it appears as though we had enough information, but the investigation reveals to us there's additional evidence that's conflicting with the information we originally had, we may say to ourselves, then that's going to prevent us from being able to get to that level of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Or it appeared as though we had the elements there, but digging into it a little further, found something else that said, nope, this element is missing. The last thing that I'll say about this is that it is also possible in the state of Alaska for criminal charges to be filed by law enforcement officers themselves. The Alaska State Troopers, police officers, are all given the authority in the state of Alaska to file criminal charges. When they do that, it's called the complaint. When prosecutors file charges, it's either referred to as an information or an indictment. So some of those will be the result of law enforcement having filed a complaint. We review it and we say, well, actually, we don't think there's going to be enough evidence there to proceed. So all of that is grouped into that set of dismissals that occur. Then you see the number of plea agreements that are obtained as of October 12th of last year, and then the number of trials. And having five trials already conducted is actually a pretty significant number of trials already for that time period. And then in active prosecution, you can see that there are still 201 that are there. For the plea agreements, you'll note that there are some that plead out as non-sex offenses. The report itself highlights some of the resolutions for the non-sex offenses or cases that are accepted as a non-sex offense. For instance, I think we had one case that was not accepted as a sex offense but was accepted as murder. We had another one that was accepted as assault in the second degree. We had another one that was accepted as a burglary. And so there are various other types of crimes that while the sex offense may not be charged, we wouldn't want to leave anyone with the impression that that means we're not taking enforcement action. It just may not be the sex offense itself that ultimately is accepted or that ends up being the conviction. So that's sort of a general explanation of the processing. Unless there's any questions, I'm going to move on to slide 6.
Actually, I have a couple of questions,
please.
But it isn't about this slide specifically, but as you know, I saw the prior years, but I don't have them with me.
Okay.
If we looked at the prior 2 years' report in terms of the total sex offense referral and whether it's the number of cases that you took, the percentage of cases that were prosecuted or percentage of cases that were declined, because they're essentially two sides of the same coin.
Sure.
But if you go back to the report that we received in 20, I guess that you would have sent to the legislature in 2021, a year before this one, in 2020, 2 years before this one, what do those overall numbers look like?
So to the chair, the answer is that it's very similar. If you look on the report on page 5 itself of the one you have, it indicates that this is the third report and that each year law receives around 600 sex offense referrals. That's about 4 lines down in that paragraph on page 5. And it says that each year a little less than half of the referrals were declined, always primarily for evidentiary reasons. And again, falling down in that same paragraph, the vast majority of them remained active prosecutions at the time of the reports. So the reporting itself has remained consistent over the 3 years. And the only other thing that I would note is that this particular report doesn't actually go to the legislature. It goes to the Alaska Judicial Council. And you can find the previous copies of it on the Alaska Judicial Council's websites. It becomes part of the report that was published by the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission in the previous 2 years. This year, there's not a report from that body, but this particular report was sent to the Judicial Council again, and of course, we've made a copy available to you. I'm happy to provide any of the previous reports to you, but if you wanted to look, those are places that you can find them.
So at some level, the level of sex offense, the level of sex crimes in Alaska is reflected by the referrals to prosecution, and the prosecution has basically stayed the same during the reporting period.
To the chair, I think you can adequately or appropriately conclude that prosecution has remained similar. I'm cautious about saying that sex offenses are exactly the same because that would require a separate analysis of how many are reported to law enforcement and then how many law enforcement actually refers to us. The referrals we receive have remained relatively consistent, but I can't tell you that the incidences of them have remained consistent. For that, I would recommend people go to the uniform crime reporting that the Alaska State Troopers puts out. They have a specific report on sex offenses and the numbers that they receive and sort of what they've done with them. That's not part of what I have in front of us today, and I apologize, I don't have that report with me, but that's where you could find those things.
Pass on that one. Other question, we passed last legislative session, mm-hmm. I think it became effective of January 1st this year,
yes.
A modification, a change in the definition of consent.
Yes.
Obviously, it wouldn't be reflected in these statistics.
Correct.
But what is any idea yet whether that change in definition will have any changes in the statistics that you're seeing in terms of cases accepted for prosecution or declined?
To the chair, the answer very simply is yes, it will have an impact on that. The degree of the impact, it's too early for us to tell. Just this morning, I had a conversation with one of our prosecutors about a case that they were accepting under the new subsection that was created for consent. So I know that it's already having an impact. You accurately note that it went into effect January 1 of this year, so a little less than 2 months ago. But we are already seeing cases that we would have otherwise had to decline that we now will accept. Again, the degree to which that will occur, I couldn't tell you that exactly at this moment. When that bill passed, unfortunately, in the way in which it passed, fiscal notes were not able to be attached to it. And so what our anticipation is that once we have a sense of what that impact will be, we'll come back to the legislature and talk about whether that had any impact on our operations.
And I think the last question I have on this particular topic, given the appropriate lag time between when mm-hmm. cases are referred and decisions are made and we get these reports, how far from now would you expect to see a report like this starting to reflect any change in trends as a result of that change in the law?
This particular report, since it's only happening in this year, I would expect it to be about not 24, but 25's report should begin to reflect the changes that we see happening right now on the ground. And that report would cover this fiscal year that we're currently in. Keep in mind that change only goes into effect midway through the fiscal year, so half of the year would be impacted by it. You're not going to see a full year's impact until the following year, which would be 2026.
And that would be October of 2025 would be the initial...
Yes.
About half of the impact, and then we get a full picture in what was reported in October of 2026.
I'm making sure I'm doing my math correctly.
Your time.
So it's going to be a two-year look back. So the report itself we produce in October, but the way I think of it is needing to go out by the time I'm talking to the legislature about it. And so I think I'm talking to the legislature in 26, but the report itself would come out in 25, if that makes sense.
So October of 2025 would give a full year statistic.
Let me do my math correctly here. You're challenging me. I went to law school because I wasn't good at math. The report in October of 25 will cover half would be covering where we are right now, and that's where you're going to get half of it. So it would be October of 26 to get the full year's statistics.
Right. So we would actually, in the presentation to the legislature, it would be 26 would get half year, and 27 legislative session would get the full year.
That sounds right. Yes, sir.
Okay. Just in the world of managing expectations,
yes.
I think it's important to at least it strikes me, it's important that we have realistic expectations about when we make a change like this, which is a very important change, that we really won't be in a position to make much of an evaluation about how has it worked for some years in the future.
So by the time this particular report comes out, what we're hoping is that you will have seen a number, some period of time go by for the processing of those cases. But for instance, it won't take us that long for us to tell you how many of those cases did we file? For example, if all that was asked of me is how many of those referrals did you receive last year, I could tell you how many referrals we received last year for sex offenses. I can't do the rest of the processing that you find in Figure 1 on Slide 5 because you won't have had enough time for that. But I could tell you how many referrals we had. So our ability to come back and talk about impacts on the resources for the department, I can do that earlier. Talking about the full processing of it will take a little longer.
asking enough questions for everybody.
I'm going to move on to slide six. And slide six really talks a little bit more about what you've already heard me describe, and that's the duties of a prosecutor. And so what slide six really has is just a couple of different quotes that highlight this. The primary duty of a lawyer engaged in public prosecution is not to convict, but rather to see that justice is done. That's actually what our mission statement says, is that we're to seek justice. And so I know at times people are concerned when they see the statistics of the cases we decline. And my response to that is, we are never telling a victim that something did not happen to them or that what they're telling us isn't accurate. That's never what we are indicating by that. But our obligation as prosecutors is only to bring forward those cases that we believe we can prove. And that legal obligation means we have this ethical duty, not just to victims, but to everyone, to only bring forward those cases that we can. And that's about seeing that justice is done. And the second one is a famous quote from a United States Supreme Court case, Berger v. U.S. And in that one of the justices, Justice Sutherland, has this quote that a prosecutor may prosecute with earnest and vigor. Indeed, he, at the time, prosecutors were mainly him, indeed, he should do so. But while he may strike hard blows, he's not at liberty to strike foul ones. It is as much his duty to refrain from improper methods calculated to produce a wrongful conviction as it is to use every legitimate means to bring about a just one. Both of those talk to that same concept of why we decline cases, of why we will dismiss cases. That's just the obligation that prosecutors have, unfortunately. The next slide is slide number seven. And in slide seven, this is really to help you understand the stages and that chart in processing. So we are involved in the investigations. Oftentimes, law enforcement will contact us and talk to us about cases they have and what they think they ought to be doing with them. Our statistics capture the ones that are formally referred to us, not every case in which a law enforcement officer may have called us to ask us questions, to get assistance on a search warrant, to talk about how the investigation is going. So informally, sometimes we will have conversations with law enforcement about that. But the report only covers that second bullet point, which is that formal referral. And then, of course, the screening is whether or not we file charges versus whether or not we've declined it. The pretrial litigation is often where we're doing the initial investigation or other motions are filed that help us figure out, was all the evidence collected pursuant to constitutional means? Do we have search and seizure problems? Are there statement problems? Those are all the sorts of things that can occur after a case is charged, but that can cause us to have to dismiss one of them. And then, of course, you go on to pretrial resolutions, which is the plea agreements, trials, which are clearly mentioned, and post-trial litigation, which we don't talk about very much in that screening report. But our experience is that we will have sex offenses that are charged, tried, convicted, go up on appeal, and by the time the appeal is decided, it can be 7 or even 9, 10 years later. That's not uncommon for how long these cases can take to work their way all the way through our system. I would very much hope that we are able to find methods to decrease that amount of time, but that's sort of the status of where we are currently. So that's the sex offense report. From here, I would intend to turn to the second topic, which is recruitment and retention, unless there are any other questions for me about the report.
Start with Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, has the changing definitions, has that affected our record keeping, or is the record keeping done under such a category that even though we may add or increase definition within it, that we're tracking the trend where it's not being skewed by any changes in what's statutorily considered trackable? Thank you.
So through the chair, Senator Kaufman, the answer to your question is that as we have changes in the law, our case management system will differentiate those subsections of the statutes. And so we'll be able to delineate how many are we now prosecuting because of the change in definition that we wouldn't have previously been able to prosecute. We should be able to determine that from our record keeping, and it shouldn't cause any problems for us.
Thank you.
Senator Thiel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question about, I guess, what resources the department has available for an additional investigation. Certainly, you mentioned that sometimes once cases are referred, you look at them further, you work on them, you're preparing them, and additional issues arise with investigation. Does the Department of Law have civilian investigators? Do you go back to troopers and municipal police departments? What what are the resources that you can deploy in those situations?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, we don't have investigators within the Department of Law by and large. The only places that we have it, I think, are in our Medicaid fraud unit. There are a couple of offices, I believe it's the Anchorage office and maybe the Bethel office, that we have tried pilot programs where law enforcement agencies will loan us officers that are assigned to us to try and do follow-up work for us, but they don't actually work for us. That's very distinct from what you would find in the lower 48, where many prosecutors' offices actually will have investigators that work expressly for them to go out and do follow-up investigations. We do not have that benefit or that privilege here. We have to go back to the law enforcement agencies and say, we need this additional follow-up done. And because they don't work for us, they can prioritize that as they see appropriate within all of their other casework. And I don't mean that in any way to be derogatory. It's just that has to be worked in with the other things that they have. And so sometimes we will have results that are very quick, that are very helpful to us, and other times with the press of other business that those agencies have, the follow-up doesn't get done in a timely enough manner. And that can result in additional delays.
Follow-up? I guess the follow-up would be, do we then have the right structure?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that is a very good question, one that we've talked about, but at this point, the department has never come forward to say we would like to create additional investigators within the Department of Law. The challenge for us in that is managing investigators. We understand how to manage lawyers, but investigators start to have other responsibilities, and then you have questions of, is this person going to be certified under the Alaska Police Standards Council? Are they going to be, as you described, a civilian investigator? Are they going to be a law enforcement officer? Do they fall under APSC? Are they then going to be carrying firearms and handcuffs? And then who's making sure that they're appropriately trained? So it becomes a much larger sort of, I don't know if bureaucratic's the right word, but it becomes a much larger management issue of how do you structure that? That's something that we have not yet been able to resolve, but I'll tell you that's a conversation that's been going on for over a decade now between us and DPS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got at least one municipality that has a model for you.
That does raise the typical question. To change that, does that require a statutory change, or is that just a budget decision you all can make?
Mr. Chair, that is strictly a budgetary decision. We have the ability to figure out those structures internally. There's no statute that the legislature needs to pass. There would be a budget associated with it, so obviously that would have to run through the legislature. But beyond that, it's a matter of management and structures, things that the executive branch can do so long as the budget's presented for it.
And so just for comparison's sake, for those who might be watching as well and more what's going on in Alaska, on a federal level, does the U.S. Attorney's Office have investigators in their office, or are they similar to you that they have FBI agents and DEA agents that are working cases, and if they have investigative follow-ups, do they have somebody in their office that follows up, or do they contact the FBI or the DEA or whoever the investigative agency is to do those works, if you know?
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question. I do not know the answer to it. The way I would describe it is this. I'm unaware of any investigators that are in their office. I know that they communicate frequently with the FBI or other agencies, and one of the distinctions between us and the Department of Justice is those other agencies that you name, the FBI and such, all are part of the Department of Justice, whereas here it's a separate department. So if they need something, they may have a different structure that they're able to utilize in terms of supervision and who kind of has the authority. But they may, I don't know, I don't work there, they may have other options of how they try to manage those resources.
The other questions, I think that gets us through the sex offense report portion and on to recruitment and retention.
We'll move on to slide 8 here. And really what slide 8's trying to do is give you an overview of, quite frankly, the greatest challenge that faces the Department of Law, and that's recruitment and retention of personnel. Our mission simply cannot be accomplished without appropriate personnel. And when I say appropriate, I mean both in terms of quantity of personnel as well as the quality of the personnel. And this really has described in two ways, both the recruitment and the retention. On the recruitment side, you see that we have an applicant shortage. And in the following slides, we're getting into more details about this. But we're going to talk about both nationally what's going on, as well as Alaska specific. And then when we come to the retention side of it, that's really about where we have turnover, where the folks that leave us. And in prosecutors' offices across the country, ever since I've been a prosecutor, it's always been understood people come to prosecutors' offices generally to get trial experience and then to move on. But there have also, historically, always been some career prosecutors. And that's one of the things that's been able to balance that out. The turnover rate that we've seen, we've reported in the legislature over the last several years, has been somewhere between 22 and 37% for prosecutors. I don't have statistics to tell you what the turnover rate is in the lower 48 or some of the other offices. I can only tell you from my own personal experiences, having talked with some of those folks and having worked in some of those other offices. And 22 to 37% turnover in a given year seems high. Again, I don't have statistics to offer you. I can't tell you how that matches up with everybody else, but it seems like an awful lot of people that turn over and we're then having to fill those positions for.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you so much for this presentation. It's really helpful. I have two requests for data points. The first would be, we've seen from some of the other departments that are experiencing similar high attrition rates, what is the cost per person to replace that individual? Kind of just a broad brush on what that would look like. I know for OCS, it's $54,000 per OCS worker that exits out from service. And then the second would be, if we could see this turnover potentially broken down by district, so not just lumping Alaska into one big block, but what is the turnover rates happening in the Nome area? Is it 37%? Is it higher in the Fairbanks area? Is it 37% or is it lower? Just curious to know if there is higher attrition in particular parts of the state.
So through the chair, Senator Tobin, in terms of the cost to replace personnel, we'll have to talk with some of our colleagues about how they've come up with those figures, because I don't know exactly how I would put a cost on what it takes to replace somebody. What I can tell you is that the department over the last decade has held the position, or the position that bringing on a new prosecutor, it generally takes us about 2 years to train that person. And within that 2 years, they're generally handling lower level offenses. After 2 years, they start to do better. That's a bad way of saying that. After 2 years, they get to a level that we feel they can operate a little bit more independently. Really at about 5 to 7 years is when we find that folks are really developing that skill set to take on those most serious cases in a way that is efficient. That's not to say that people with less experience, 1 or 2 years, don't end up handling serious cases. That's happening right now in our state. We have people with very little experience that have to take on very serious cases. But their ability to manage that case efficiently and to see all of the issues in a timely manner really changes over time. I can think back over my own career. I can think of homicides that I've prosecuted, and I can sort of hold my head in my hand and think, oh my gosh, what was I thinking? What was I doing? And that only comes with experience. You look back and go, well, I'm not going to do that like that anymore. I'm going to do that differently next time. And so what we find is it really takes about that 5 to 7 year period before they really start cooking, and they're very efficient in what they do. In terms of by district, we can certainly try and get you information by district, but what becomes challenging for us in looking at it by district is that we not infrequently have people transfer from office to office within the state. And so when I give you turnover rates, that turnover rate is people that leave the department. If I start trying to analyze by district, that's going to be a different analysis where I have to look at, okay, when do people leave that district? And now we get into all sorts of other issues. Is somebody moving from one place to another because there are salary benefits for them? Are they moving from one place to another for family reasons? There's a lot of other issues that start to play into that. So we can certainly try and get you that information. I just want you to understand it'll be a very different analysis than what I can present to you today.
Senator Tobin.
And just to clarify, we've heard from many other departments that some of the issues around housing, yes, some of the issues are other types of systemic problems that might be unaddressed by simply putting additional resources or incentives or bonuses into the position. So that's really where my question is coming from, is around trying to figure out some of the structural changes that we need to make.
And through the chair, Senator Tobin, I appreciate that clarification. I can tell you that the Department of Law does have a program right now to pursue housing in rural Alaska, because we know that that is a challenge for some of those offices. And so if there are other specifics like that, I haven't had an opportunity to come by your office yet, but I'd be happy to engage in further conversation with you about that, because we do pay attention to those issues and what may be challenges in specific offices. And you're absolutely correct. It's not simply salaries. Salaries do make a difference, and we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. But those other details that you're describing are things that need to be paid attention to.
Just again, minor clarity, when you talk about turnover, that's really the number who leave less than number who come in. So your turnover reflects the delta between people.
No.
So your turnover, because one of the presenters we heard on another day, turnover reflected what I say, the delta between those that leave and those that come in. Your turnover is strictly those who leave on this statistic.
Okay. Yes, and we're going to get to a slide later on that's going to show you how many left in a year, and then I'm going to tell you how many we hired in that year, and you'll see that that delta would not pan out from the description you just gave. So I don't know who else has done it that way, but I'm glad you asked the question, because sometimes we say the same words, but we mean different things by it, so I appreciate that. We're on slide 9, and what slide 9 shows you, you'll note in the lower left-hand corner, it says Senate Judiciary, and it gives you today's date for the 15th of 2023. But then when you look on the lower right-hand side, it also says slide number 9, and then you have a 14 a little bit above that. And if you follow up the right-hand column, you get to another date of 1/29/2020. That's because what this slide has done is it's taken a previous budget slide that we presented in a presentation to the legislature back in 2020, and we're showing you some of the information that we've been talking about. So just understand that's a slide within a slide. And what this particular slide is showing you is the difference. This came from an organization called NeoGov. And NeoGov is an organization that helps public sector agencies across the country with recruitment and retention issues and helps to track it. And what they were able to do is to give us this information that applicants between 2013 and 2018, because this slide was published in 2019, the number of applicants decreased by 8%. But in the same time frame, the number of jobs that had opened up increased by 29%. And so the difference, when you combine all of that, is a 37% difference in what was going on. And what they described is that there were 10,000 baby boomers retiring per day, or 11% of the workforce per year, and that was from the Washington Post. When we looked here just in Alaska, and this was from our Alaska Department of Administration back in 2020, 20% of the Alaska state workers projected to retire in 1 to 5 years. This was, again, back in 2020. 11% of the state workers were eligible to retire within less than a year, whether or not they actually did retire or not. We have seen a few retirements in the Department of Law, but most of the folks that we find that leave the Department of Law, at least on the criminal side, is not due to retirement. We find most of them move on for jobs in the private sector or some other places that we're going to talk about here in just a minute. Slide 10, then, is really trying to get you into a few more specifics. So that 8% decrease actually comes from the last slide. But the average of 20% fewer applications per job. So I want to make sure that I'm clear in the distinction between the 8% and the 22%. The 8% was based on a survey of people looking for public sector jobs, but the actual number of applications that came in was 22% less. So even though the drop had only been 8% in the people who said they were looking, the applications that came in were significantly less. And noted beyond that, and you'll see NeoGov quoted here again, legal has suffered the biggest impact in applicants per job, with a 64% decline in applications. About 2 weeks ago, I was in Washington, D.C. at a national job fair for prosecutors. It was put on by an organization called the National District Attorneys Association. It's the first time we've done a job fair specifically for prosecutors on a nationwide basis. And so I was there with about 51 other prosecutors' offices from all over the country. Maricopa County, which is Phoenix, Arizona, Cook County, which is Chicago, Fulton, which is Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia, most of the state of Colorado, I think, was actually there. We had folks from all over. And what we heard at that conference, because we were both trying to hire people and we were also talking amongst ourselves, was everyone talked about the fact that it used to be, when most of us started, we would have stacks of applications on our desk for people that wanted the jobs. And now it's just a few. 1, 2, 3, 4. We've had times when we posted jobs here in Alaska for which we received no applications for months and months. So it is a challenge in getting those applications. And the next bullet point on here, again, this is a like the last slide. This is a slide that was presented back in 2020, a slide within a slide. And at that time, we had said there was a 19% decrease in Alaska applicants over the last 5 years, highlighting that what I heard from my colleagues in Washington, D.C. just 2 weeks ago is precisely what we've been seeing here in Alaska for some time. And the last bullet point on there talks about 49 prosecutor positions recruited in 2019 with an average of less than 5 applicants per position. And as you all know, the number of applicants doesn't always mean you have good quality applicants. We are fortunate that we do still get folks that are of a good quality and we hire them, but just because you get applications doesn't mean those are necessarily people you want to hire. What this overall means is that we've had fewer applicants. The applicants that are applying have been less experienced. There are longer recruitment periods to find good quality people. And that's created greater stress on current employees because then they have to handle the caseloads that otherwise should have been handled by other folks. Slide 11 is the good news. We have seen...
Senator Kaufman has a question.
Yes.
Thank you. Through the chair to Deputy AG Skidmore. This may be uncomfortable for a couple people in this room, but I've been reading about the legal profession being one of the early adopters of AI as a means of automating the kind of the heavy duty writing and, you know, some of the clerical processes in the legal profession.
Huh.
And same true for the aspects of like engineering that, you know, where documentary materials have to be, are deliverables.
So mm-hmm.
Wherever there's written deliverables. Have you had any discussions around the use of, I know there's probably proprietary packages out there, that software packages that can help produce some of those materials. I know it can't do everything, but have you looked into that just since these employment trends are beyond national, they're global in all but a few cases. The demographic bell curve just is not good as far as, you know, everything from employment to childbirth. So have you looked into any of that? Is that anything you're familiar with, or is it something we can maybe talk about later?
And I can't speak for Mr. Skidmore, but as one of the lawyers in the room, the question doesn't make me uncomfortable.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, I rarely find myself sitting at the table here and a question's asked that completely takes me off guard. You've succeeded. I have never heard of AI being used to write legal briefs, so I certainly have not had any discussions with anyone about it. My initial reaction is I would need to understand more about that to decide whether or not I think that would be how successful that would be. Because when I think of legal issues in writing briefs, there are so many nuances. Some people describe practicing criminal law as it's so easy. Civil law, there's all sorts of things that you have to do, and it's always changing. And criminal law, that's so straightforward. I mean, you just have to do the same thing over and over and over again. And I tend to think that the people who describe it that way fail to appreciate the nuances and the fact patterns that we receive. So would artificial intelligence, AI, be capable of processing those things and helping us to do those sorts of things? I honestly don't know the answer to that because I've not heard anything about it, but you've piqued my curiosity and I look forward to the conversation.
Thank you. Follow up?
Senator Kaufman.
My advice to young folks is be a plumber because that's going to be the last one to go. So anyway, thank you.
I don't see other questions. Please continue.
Thank you. We were on slide 11, and what I was saying is the good news is guarded optimism here, folks. This graph in front of you is the number of applicants for prosecutors' jobs per month that we've seen since May of 2022 to up to today in 2023. And you'll note from May to November, we were fluctuating between 5 and up to 11 applications per month. That's not a lot of applications for the entire month to be receiving when during that time frame we would have about 24 positions that were open. So clearly not enough applications to match the number of positions that we had. November 1 is when there was a change in statute that impacted salaries for attorneys in Alaska. And for that, I say thank you to you all in the legislature, because that's something that you all passed last year. And I often get the question, did that make a difference? Well, I would point back to the graph. That went into effect in November. Come December, we saw an increase. And then in January, it more than doubled again. Now, does that mean that's a trend that will continue? I think it's too early to say that at this moment. But guarded optimism, that seems to be a very positive sign at the moment. And I would note for February, we're here on February 15th, so only about halfway through the month. The number of applications that have come in, I don't know if that's accurate up to date. That was accurate as of last week sometime, that we had had 7 at that point. But in talking to some other folks, I know we're doing interviews actually today for a number of positions. So I don't know if that's gone back to look at the people that applied in January, or if those were folks that applied in February, or if we've had more since then. But that gives you a quick snapshot of that. The other thing that I wanted to give you a quick snapshot of, and I apologize, I didn't have this in the slide presentation. We have here, I'm going to go to the next slide, and I think this will make sense there. Here we go, slide 12. So the positive trend, still more work to be done. This reflects the numbers we've reported to the legislature in 18, 19, 20, 21, and now 22. And what you'll see is the turnover, strictly people leaving, went from 36.5% now down to 19%. Sort of the year that seemed to be a little off was 2020. That was, of course, right in the middle of the pandemic for us. Interestingly enough, a lot of people seem to be leaving jobs during the pandemic and looking other places. For us, we found that during that time frame, we actually became more stable, not that more people were leaving. But in 2022, where we had 25 people leave us, things of note. 6 of those 25, a full quarter of them, transferred from the criminal division to the civil division of the Department of Law. Basically what happened is they said, it's great, we have added pay, we're comfortable with that, but the civil division offers a better work-life balance. They are not on call at night. They do not have to respond to homicide scenes. They do not have the same type of caseloads that we do, and so we saw fully a quarter of the people that left us move to the civil division. Prior to that, the civil division had been experiencing the same type of challenges we were for recruitment and retention. They are in a much better position than we are today. Of those 25 that left us in 2022, 2 of them transferred to the Department of Administration. So again, not leaving state government, but just went to lawyers on the defense side at the Public Defender Agency or the Office of Public Advocacy. And lastly, we had 3 of those individuals that had licensing issues. That is, they took the bar exam and were not able to pass the bar exam. Let me go through and talk about some of these things each individually. In terms of transferring to the civil division, there's ongoing conversations between us and the civil division about what do we do to manage those issues. The work-life balance that they are able to offer, the fact that their folks don't necessarily have to be on call or respond to murder scenes, those are things that we have to figure out. What do we do to allow folks to be comfortable working for the criminal division when there are additional requirements that we have for our folks that they don't necessarily have? For example, they work core hours. They're able to do teleworking more. For us, our job's about going to court. You can't really telework going to court very much. It really requires you to show up in court. There are some hearings we do telephonically, but that's not the preferred way for that to happen. It's about going to court. It's about doing trials. It's about doing evidentiary hearings. Those are not things you can do from afar. So we're looking at how do we manage those issues. And the licensing issues, you all may have seen in the Anchorage Daily News just earlier this week a report that indicated there is a change that the Board of Governors for the Bar Association has recommended. Alaska is the only state in the nation without a law school. And yet we had the highest score required on the licensing test to become a lawyer. There is something called the UBE, which is the Universal Bar Exam. And the score on that, Alaska has it set currently at 280 is the score you need. And yet most other states are at 270 or below. I think there was one or two that were above 270, but everybody else was below 270. And so we, myself, Ms. Shiro from the Alaska Public Defender Agency, and James Stenson from the Office of Public Advocacy, jointly wrote a letter to the Board of Governors supporting that reduction in the score. If that is adopted by the U.S., not by the U.S., by the Alaska Supreme Court, because the Board of Governors made the recommendation, the Supreme Court has to approve that. If they do, those three individuals for us that had licensing issues would come back to us because they would have achieved scores that then were passing scores. And to the point that the chair made earlier about the term turnover, in 2022, we hired 31 lawyers. So if we had 25 leave us, but we hired 31, clearly we would have been in the positive if we were trying to do that delta between the two. That's not what we're looking at. We did hire 31. 13 of them had experience. And here's the other thing of note. 6 of them were former employees that came back to the criminal division. They came back to the criminal division because of the change in salaries. They each expressly have indicated that. That was one of the reasons that incentivized them to return. And those are not all people that are in tier 1 through 3, so it's impacting defined benefit. Those, some of them, are also people in tier 4, where it's a defined contribution. Even those said that change in salary does make a difference. So to the comment earlier from Senator Tobin, is it just about salary? No, it's not. There are clearly other things we need to do for housing in certain offices, but the salary increase has definitively already had an impact for us. We know that without a doubt. I know of at least 3 attorneys that were eligible to retire who have all told us they don't plan to retire in the next year or two. They will stay with us for several more years, which is also a benefit to us. So on the left-hand side of the slide, improving efforts that were made, salaries were increased. We've done more in terms of providing training. We've started an onboarding academy that we premiered just this past October. We have an annual conference that we do. We've also hired someone specifically to do training in the criminal division. We've revamped our website. We have hired folks to provide us a social media presence. I often like to tell people I may be one of the only people in the world that does not have a social media account. I have 0 of them. I hate social media. I'm on the record. I hate social media. I think it is a scourge on society. That having been said, I understand that's how a lot of people are communicating. So we have started a social media presence for the Department of Law. We're also expanding the locations in which we are posting our recruitments and attending job fairs. I indicated I had been to one last week. We also did another job fair earlier that resulted in an increase in applications for us as well. So there are ongoing efforts. So I don't mean to say that the increase in salaries is the only thing that would be driving this turnaround. There are other factors that we believe are at play there, but I wanted to make sure we gave you that full picture. Last but not least, I had this page here because I wanted to let you know we currently have 24 prosecutor positions that do not have a person in them. Of those 24, 12 have people that are hired but will not be joining us until sometime between now and October of this year. So law school students have to finish up law school before they come and join us. That left us with another 12 positions. Of those 12, there are 8 we are actively recruiting for, 4 that we know what's going to happen with them. We have folks that have either applied and we expect to be filling them, or there are other things that we'll be doing with those positions. So that really tells us that right now where we are is trying to get another 8 attorneys. And that's far better off than where we've been in a very long time. That is the last slide that I have for you, unless you all have questions for me.
There are questions. Senator Kaufman, you're up first.
Thank you, through the chair. Do you have in your operations any formalized processes for capturing and implementing efficiency improvements? If there's a good idea for how work can be done more effectively, efficiently, or with fewer resources, do you have a good system in place to bubble that up, evaluate it, and then deploy the idea as policy should it make sense?
through the chair, Senator Kaufman, I don't know how formal the process is, but we certainly have, there are 13 offices across the state, prosecutor's offices, plus an office of special prosecutions and an office for appeals. In each of those offices, there are office chiefs. We certainly encourage people to bring solutions forward. We have work groups that are looking for efficiencies and various things within the criminal division. It's something we are always talking about and looking for. I don't know that I have a formal process per se, though. I tend to think that we are a small enough department that we're able to communicate fairly nimbly and respond to things fairly quickly. One of the biggest efficiencies that we tried to find was the implementation of our new case management system, which went from paper files to electronic files. We're in the process of trying to get all of the offices in the same instance of that. What I mean by that is that most of the offices, their information is stored in the cloud so that people can access it from anywhere. All you need is an internet connection. But we have some of our offices, Kotzebue, Nome, Bethel, Dillingham, in which the internet connection is not strong enough to put them in the same place. We're working on that this year in some of our budget requests. And if we can get everyone into the same place, that allows everyone to get to the files to back up one another simultaneously. Gives us all the ability to look at the files when we need to. And if we can get that system working at optimal efficiency, it also has significant reporting capabilities that will help us look for those trends and patterns. We've also had a lot of discussions about how we can make case management flow more effectively. And we have another request to look at us helping manage digital evidence, the receiving of it, the storing of it, the providing it in discovery. All of those things are about efficiencies as well. So I do think we are constantly looking at efficiencies, but I don't know that I can tell you there's a formal mechanism per se. Thank you.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. I feel like I need to hold on the millennial fort here on the social media presence. But I do appreciate the expanding posting locations. I know, particularly for folks my age and younger, resources like LinkedIn are where we get a lot of our job application information. And so having a diversified space that you offer those opportunities, hopefully we'll get a more diverse pool of applicants, which we know more diverse voices in the room bring different lived experience, which helps us do our work better. But that's not really my question. My question is, and you can answer this offline if you prefer, there has been some chatter on social media around abolishing the bar exam. And we had an interesting debate in our office about it recently. We have some folks who are looking toward law school here in the near future. And it has been an interesting discussion, particularly folks my age, really talking about equity. So I'm curious about your thoughts, particularly with the reduction in the score and your recommendation and your letter of support of that. What do you think the future of being a lawyer in the state of Alaska might look like if that is a direction that folks my age are thinking of headed?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, first you'd be pleased to know I've heard of LinkedIn, and that's one of the social media websites that the Department of Law is now utilizing. To your question about the bar exam, I have had some conversations with other lawyers, some of them members of the Board of Governors, about the utility or the value that the bar exam may or may not provide. I don't know that there's a definitive answer at this time. All I can tell you is that it's what the Bar Association has traditionally used. It's what I expect they will continue to use. I have not seen any data or statistics to indicate that the bar exam results in different passage rates for diversified populations. I don't think that that's something that's going on the way that we sometimes hear about with standardized tests, such as the SAT or things of that nature. So I think that there is still some value in the bar exam. Does that ultimately need to be the mechanism that the Bar Association uses? I don't know the answer to that, and quite frankly, I think that's really a discussion for the Board of Governors in what they think is appropriate. I don't sit on the Board of Governors, so I wouldn't presume to tell them what to do, but I agree with you. It's a very interesting conversation. I, too, will be watching, though. I don't know if I'll be around long enough to see that future of no bar exam. Additional questions?
I don't see any. Thank you very much for coming and joining us today and continuing the ongoing discussion. I guess just reflecting on a discussion you and I had when we get into this retention issue,
I think you and I were largely in agreement that we may have some statutory changes that may make sense, but the biggest issue that the public should be really concerned about in terms of effective criminal prosecution, it's this recruiting and retention and having a full staff is more important than anything.
Yes, I agree that you cannot do the work without the people there to do it. I will reiterate what I told you as well. I do think that there are changes that can be done in statutes to provide more efficiencies, back to the concept that Senator Kaufman had mentioned. I think that trying to improve our laws and pay attention to those things are also very important and valuable as we face new issues. But in terms of the core underlying need, without the people, I agree with you, the rest doesn't make a difference.
All right, thank you very much. I see nothing else, so we are going to adjourn for the day. Following the same theme, when we return on Friday, we will be hearing from the Public Defender Agency, probably on very similar topics, but probably not on the sex offense report. So with that, we will stand adjourned. The time is 2:36 p.m.